Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Dr. Frank Salter. Frank is a well-known Australian academic and political scientist, known for his work in biological science, particularly the integration of biology with social and political studies. Frank has authored several notable books and numerous articles, which examine topics such as organisational power, ethnic kinship, and the evolutionary basis of social cohesion. Today we discuss what he means by terms such as multiculturalism, civic nationalism, and ethno-nationalism, whether a nation can be bound together simply by values, whether there are any ways to effectively manage multi-ethnic societies, why Western nations in modern times adopted very different policies compared to other traditional nation states, what should be done in future to avoid Australia and other Western nations experiencing the same fate as South Africa, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Dr. Frank Salter, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
You have been a long-time critic of multiculturalism, amongst other things. Peter Credlin, who is the Sky News host and former chief of staff to Tony Abbott, she said something similar on her show recently, that multiculturalism has failed. What do you mean by the term multiculturalism?
Well, it has many meanings. The most common misconception among politicians is that multiculturalism means diversity. It's not. It's an ideology. So that's step one. It's not a description. It's an ideology. It could be many things. And the organization I'm associated with now, the British Australian Community, we see ourselves as a multicultural agency. So we're in the game. We're involved in multicultural affairs. But we like to think normatively, not in real multiculturalism as it's been practiced since the 1970s, but as it should be practiced in a normative way. One would imagine that multiculturalism is a way for people to retain, it gives them permission in a way to retain their identities. Even if they're gently assimilating into the Australian mainstream, they can still be proud of Greece, where they came from, or China, where they came from, wherever it might be. And in Bob Hawke's terms, there's no hierarchy of descents. We all came from the ancestors of equivalent status in relation to the Australian nation. That's the normative multiculturalism that we're introduced to. Then we come to real multiculturalism. And I just agree with now the book is The Rise and Fall of Anglo-America by Eric Kaufman. Eric Kaufman argued in 2004. He's now become a major theoretician of ethnicity and nationalism based in London. He's Canadian, but he's based in London. And his conclusion is that, focusing on American multiculturalism, it was from the beginning asymmetric multiculturalism. It was meant for all the minorities, but not for the founding majority. In fact, from a strategic perspective, it's difficult to imagine all these groups cooperating when in many ways they're at each other's throats. They don't share interests. I'll give you an example. When Tony Abbott attempted, when he was during his 2 years of prime ministership, when he attempted to reform Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, I think it was called the Rainbow Coalition or the United Nations of Australia. There was some nickname given to it. And all the major minorities got together and as a body lobbied against reform of 18C, right? And that, for me, exemplifies another reality of multiculturalism, which is that it's an ethnic hierarchy that subordinates the founding majority, the founding ethnic group, and actually mobilize, they gain unity by mobilizing together against us. So it's an ugly reality.
Is there any difference between the modern use of the term multiculturalism and multi-ethnic societies that existed in the past, either in empires or in other, you know, nation states?
I think there are tremendous differences. So in one talk I gave about 10 years ago, I contrasted Eastern multiculturalism, that practice in Malaysia and Korea and many Southeast Asian countries, and Western multiculturalism. And Eastern multiculturalism and also ancient diverse societies such as the Roman Empire or the Ottomans, for example, had sophisticated policies of semi-independence for minorities and so on. The biggest difference was that the overt dominance of the imperial culture. So there was no doubt that in Rome, although all roads led to Rome and people could be citizens from all around the Mediterranean basin, it's true, it came that way, but still Roman culture was dominant. And so much so, it was not an issue. It didn't have to be made an issue. In the Ottoman period, communities could retain a degree of independence, but they had to pay extra tax if they did not convert to Islam, for example. So again, the Ottoman imperial culture was dominant. Now, from the beginning in the West, from the roughly 1970s onwards, multiculturalism was predicated on white guilt. It was predicated on a rhetoric, an anti-white rhetoric, actually. This sounds harsh, but I don't think it's an exaggeration. The idea, in fact, many minority activists have argued and still argue that only white people can be racist because only they have the power to make it sting, to give it reality. So what racism is a white problem, and also we have the whole whiteness studies emerging, arguing that whiteness itself needs to be abolished, and so on and so forth. It's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. This is an elaborate put-down, an intellectualized put-down of the founding culture. Another example of the hierarchy. So when I say it's an ethnic hierarchy with us at the bottom, that's a very strong statement. I'm aware of that. Let me give some examples. For a white person, imagine a white or an Anglo, depends, to say, "Well, I'm proud to be white. I'm proud to be Anglo." Even to my ears, that's a clangor. There's something spooky about that. There's something a bit extreme about that. Why? The whole point of multiculturalism is that we should be equally able to celebrate our diversity, our background, our identity, while recognizing others and so on. That's all put aside when white people try to assert something similar. So I've looked around, another example, I've looked around and I've looked for Anglo-Celtic multicultural organizations. There are none. There are none apart from us, the BAC. So I think it's an overwhelming fact.
Aren't there like Burns Knights, Scottish and Irish associations to some extent? I mean,
they've got a pass because they're minorities. Mm. One might also say there's Morris dancing. Actually, there's not much of it. There's not much. I've seen it once at Sydney University when I was a student there. Okay. So multiculturalism has this, just to clarify before we move on, multiculturalism has a normative aspect, and I think it's flawed, by the way, but it's sweet. It's sweet. It's reasonable. It appeals to the Australian sense of fairness. And then there's the reality. And the reality is this is, and there's another aspect that's asymmetric there. If multicultural theory is correct, and we can dispense with our actual ethnic identity, and instead say, as Prime Minister Bob Hawke did in 1988, the bicentenary, our new identity is multiculturalism itself, it's diversity itself. If that's true, or even if it's false but believed, it's a warrant for open doors migration. And I think this has been a very important aspect of multiculturalism as a legitimizing ideology for open door migration. Now, there are a number of interest groups that want that, employers wanting a free flow of people back and forth and in any volume they want, keeps wages under control and frankly brings in people that they need, with expertise and willingness to work. Then there are ethnic minorities that, of course, want their relatives and their co-ethnics to be able to come and go. Of course, it's only human nature to want that. So from their point of view, multiculturalism has this wonderful licensing characteristic about it. And then that should prompt us to look more closely at the multicultural model, and it is absurd. It's anti-science, and it's reckless. It's reckless, and it has been from the beginning. That's my impression. I've gone back and I've looked at the various arguments made for it. They're absurd. They're very light on social science to the extent of ignoring social science results that conflict with their model. And it strikes me as it's a con. It's really a con forcefully applied.
Why do you think it took hold, this ideology of multiculturalism in Western nations? It doesn't exist in Japan. It doesn't exist in most other countries. You know, Eastern multiculturalism is like you said, a different beast to what exists in Canada and Australia and New Zealand and these places. What were the drivers of it? Why did it take hold after Second World War, after in the 1970s, wherever you want the date to begin?
I'll give a short answer and then a slightly longer one, or somewhat longer one. The short answer is it's a legitimizing ideology for elites that came to power, were coming to power from the 1960s on. And the intellectual legitimation of that began in the 50s. So let's go back to Kaufman's book. He argues that in the United States, and Australia would have had a knock-on, would have been implicated in a knock-on effect. In the United States, radical cosmopolitans controlled the elite university system, not all the universities, but the elite system, Princeton, Harvard on the one hand, and the quality universities, state universities on the other, by 1950, which means that the takeover by intolerant leftists had been happening for decades. And he actually traces it back to the 1920s and goes through it discipline by discipline. The final discipline to fall was American history, where they had in the previous century, the notion of manifest destiny. It may have been a little bit fanciful, but it was very pro-American. And by 1950, manifest destiny was a joke.
Yeah, right.
I think how did it happen? So I think it's an ideological justification for a change of elites, circulating elites. Very old theory from the late 19th and early 20th century. It rings true. Those elites were in culture. They were cultural elites. We're talking media, including television, movies, and so on. And the corporate elite. The corporate elite was actually a laggard. First came the cultural elites, according to Kaufman. That is true. And the corporate, growth of liberal cosmopolitans in positions of power in the corporate sector followed on after the cultural elites managed to transform elite culture. There was then a trickle-down effect with all these other influences. For example, teachers were once relatively conservative. They were part of the system. They were part. They had a stake in the state structure. They turned into one of the most radical unions that Australia has. The various teachers' federations in the states, and this is all Kaufman would say a knock-on effect from the culture wars.
One of the things people in the mainstream centre-right hold up as an alternative to multiculturalism when they do criticize it. I mean, sometimes they criticize it and then they change their mind and use the term again, and then something happens and they're again critics of it. But they hold up civic nationalism as an alternative. And essentially say we're bound together by values. And what do you understand by civic nationalism and what do you think of it?
Civic nationalism is an attempt. I'm being cynical tonight. I apologize. I'm not normally so cynical, but I think it's an attempt to bypass the reality of zero-sum conflicts of group interests. And I'll give you one example of a zero-sum conflict of interests. If the majority wants to remain the majority, as is the case in every country, by the way, with rising diversity, once it comes to the notice of the majority, look, we're falling in numbers. It's a universal response to say, we don't like that. We prefer to remain the majority, which is completely reasonable, completely understandable, because we all have an interest in living in societies in which we feel comfortable and in which ethnic conflict is kept to a minimum. And if ethnic conflict is inevitable, we win. Our side has the numbers. So that's happened right throughout the West as diversity has risen. Multicultural elites don't want to talk about that. They won't ever talk about the distribution of ethnic group interests across the society and who's winning right now and who's losing right now and whose interests will be served by this policy and whose interests by that policy and so on. It's all just shunted aside, and they'll say, I know, but let's just talk about values. The values, and of course the values are invariably deadly for the majority founding ethnic group retaining its position. For example, of course, all civilized people would love diversity. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Simply a claim. It's like Al Grasby with his mafia friends sneaking one in on us. You know, it's ridiculous. Why were so many criminals and criminal psychologies involved in the founding of multiculturalism? Why did they have to rely on these low criminal types like Grasby and who was the High Court judge?
Are you talking about
Murphy? Murphy. There's no doubt Murphy was criminally corrupt, and he escaped that by dying of bowel cancer before the legal system could fully catch up with him. But it's a bit of a query, a bit strange, isn't it? Some of the leading lights of founding multiculturalism were themselves criminally corrupt. But let's just put that aside for the moment. There are these group interests that are never discussed, except by those who embrace civic, something like civic nationalism, where it's all make believe, and the hard scientific data is simply ignored, and we talk about the joys of multicultural values or civic values or whatever terminology is used. I really see it as a huge cop out.
Isn't there something? I mean, in the United States, they put a lot of stress on this type of civic nationalism. The famous motto, "E pluribus unum," right, on the crest, "From many, one." And there was a speech by Clarence Thomas, the U.S. Supreme Court judge, Black American judge, very good conservative originalist judge, and he said, "In my youth, we believed in our country's aspirational motto, 'E pluribus unum,' despite the reality of unequal treatment. But in this postmodern multicultural world, the emphasis is decidedly on the pluribus. What's the unum?" So isn't it possible in his, he's a critic of this new world, but he's sort of harking back to a time then when there was a common culture, there was a common creed, even though, you know, as a Black American, he wasn't part of the same ethnic stock as people from, say, you know, whatever, white New Englanders. Are there degrees, right? Can multiculturalism be done poorly or be done well? And is it not possible to at least at some level stress a certain civic commonality in order to bring a variety of different people together?
Well, I think he was correct. I think that America is a model of how to make this work from a very difficult starting position, you know, from having completely rightless slaves through to having in the post-Civil War period being, you know, really severely disadvantaged and so on, and they managed to come and create more unity, which was great. But that was not caused by common values. I just don't believe it for a moment. It was caused by a joint culture, by a shared sense of fairness. And by the way, in those days, a shared Christianity, which is provides a powerful set of values. And for most of the period of the developing of Black rights, it was a bicultural country. You had a dominant, roughly 90%, 88% white Christian majority, and then you had the 10, 11, 12% Black minority. That was it. It was not a multicultural society. It was a bicultural society, very clearly so. And the majority belatedly followed in the footsteps of Great Britain by outlawing slavery, and they had to have a civil war over it. It was a horrible process. But they were following in the footsteps of Great Britain, and then they created a bicultural process. Now, I just don't believe it was multicultural. It wasn't multicultural. Now, we in the BAC, coming back to this organization, we're having a go at making the multicultural model succeed. So that's our agenda, but it's the normative multiculturalism. It's the fair and reasonable type that we embrace. And we just simply won't have a bar of being told, well, if you want to participate in the multicultural system, you have to agree with all our interests. For example, the pretense that ethnic groups don't have a stake in their representation in the population, that groups don't have demographic interests. What absurdity. And of course they do. And of course, we look at policies and assess policies according to how well they serve our interests. If that might sound familiar to you, it's what every other group does in the multicultural system. And well, now we're doing it. We're doing it as well. While being, yeah, while smiling and being very pleasant, and we love to share values with people, as long as our demography is on a steep up curve, we'll keep smiling and everything will be fine. But why would we play the game differently to them? And they've played a hard game for the last 40, 50 years.
Yeah. As you said earlier, it doesn't come naturally for, you know, even using the term white, to think of in-group preferences the way that some ethnic groups do. It doesn't occur in the same way, I think, at least, a conscious. And is it because that of the dominance of the West, right, that we've been so successful and so global that we haven't had to think of our own national ethnic interests for a while because of our dominance? Is that the core source of it? I was listening to
I agree.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast that Tucker Carlson did actually with a South African journalist. It just came out, and he was talking about all the problems in that country. And one of the points he raised was every other group in the world has a right to its own homeland except white people. Explain how that makes sense. Either no group has a right or every group has that right. And it did get me thinking. I mean, there's no way that Japan would think of adopting multiculturalism in the same way that we have in the West, or that China would think of it in those terms. Have we just simply, is this mindset to not think in your own ethnic interest, which again, I still sort of cringe at it, is that a byproduct of our success, basically?
Look, I think it goes deeper. I think you're on the right track, but I think it's a deep part of our history and our identity. It's funny, you know, because the multicultural left coalition, multiculturalism has always been a coalition between the radical left and the tribal minority right. So, but it's funny that they keep repeating the big problem in the world, the big ethnic problem is white racism. It's white racism. The facts are a little different. Whites are psychologically the most individualistic and the least collectivist in the world. That is clustered on the European peninsula and especially in Great Britain. So in a way, yes, we have it in us to do slavery, which our ancestors do. We've had it in a way to do patriotic war. We do that well and so on. But there are some fundamental things about our political and social traditions that make it difficult for us. Just one example. We didn't spend the last 1,000 years, going back to Magna Carta 800 years ago, we didn't spend our time as a minority for whom, if we want to keep our identity, we have to be highly ethnocentric and endogamous, marrying within our group. We're the opposite. All the Christian Europe consisted of majorities that controlled their own state or were parts of an empire or two, and were destined to run their own state as the empires broke down under the force of nationalism. And we are exogamous. We're not endogamous. We marry out. So it's assumed that everyone will marry everyone, and you'll have a homogeneous, assimilated population with one religion. And in the old days, it was even a patchwork of different Catholic and Protestant. Nevertheless, basically, one religion per area, and one people, and so on. And we had ethnic policies. That it's called the state apparatus. So it's called a country or a state. while minorities, long-lived minorities, had to be in order to maintain their identities and their, in their own eyes, their dignity and continuity with their ancestors, they had to be endogamous, not exogamous. They needed to have rituals which kept boosting their ethnocentrism and their xenophobia, I would say, as well. And they had to think ethnically and keep themselves apart, and they would typically undertake, typically specialize in certain areas of the economy or be forced to do so. And now we have elites. Now things have changed drastically. Now our elites are telling us, oh, but you know, you're going to be in the minority in a few decades. We're going to diversify the religion and the culture and the race, because it's all good for us without any evidence. It's all good for us, and anyone who disagrees is a racist. And so we find ourselves in these diversifying cultures right across the Western world. And we're not equipped for it. We're not set up to conduct, you know, our corporate life together in that way. We're still exogamous. We're not endogamous. We don't have those rituals to boost, frankly, to boost racism or xenophobia, ethnocentrism. We don't have those. And the cultural transition has proven to be too great for us to adapt quickly. Now, there are some individuals who are more, you know, because you know, there are individual differences across a range of psychological properties. There are more ethnocentric individuals, but they're dealt with by the system. They're dealt with, it's called political correctness, and they're dealt with and suppressed and embarrassed, and they're humiliated and so on. So I think that's what's been happening. It's what we've seen is a victory of the minorities, by the way, not largely their own doing. I think they've been acting, in the word I'm looking for, they've been clients of the real power, which is the cultural elites that have, and a lot of this I don't understand. There are aspects that I think I understand, and I'm basing it on scholarship such as Kaufman's. Multiculturalism was the result of a coalition between minority groups, very weak initially, very weak, but acting as clients of powerful, radical cultural elites. And the combination at first had little effect. Sir Robert Menzies, for example, was confronted with this. He was confronted with the radicalization of the ABC before he retired. So he was still in current affairs. There's a famous video interview he did with the ABC. It's on YouTube. You can look it up. And he was the word racist was used. Some people think you're racist. Oh, my goodness. The cultural Marxist takeover of the ABC was clear in the late 60s. It was clear in the late 60s. And he said, no, he said, what? I think the White Australia policy has been very good for Australia. It's really made us strong as a nation. He was unabashed. He was unabashed. But he was on his way out. That's the reality. He was on his way out, and the new brigade were on their way in with different values, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, there's multiculturalism as it's understood in a modern sense. There's this civic nationalism, which is often pushed. And then the other alternative, which exists in countries like, you know, like Japan and South Korea and other places, is much more of a kind of ethno-nationalism. What do you think of that? What do you think of that term? Is that something that you think is superior to the other two? Is that something we should be trying to recreate somehow? What do you make of it?
Ethno-nationalism is a reality. Australia was created as an ethno-national state. America was created as an ethno-national state. That's gone. It's been very much reduced. Our core identity remains the same. Our core identity around the world, when people think of having a Barbie and I think I'll put another shrimp on the Barbie. There's that stereotype that comes up, the Paul Hogan stereotype and all the rest of it, all our prime ministers, the population that's known is old. It's old Anglo historic nation type identity. But of course, we've diversified since then. And I don't think that an ethno-nationalist solution is appropriate. We are so diverse now. We have to take on board the diversity. We have to be able to live with it. But what is appropriate, I think, is arresting the assault on the dignity and the rights of the founding majorities. And it doesn't matter if we're 40, if we fall to 40% or 30%, we'll still have ethnic interests. We still don't want to be, we want to avoid vilification and discrimination and violence, quite often violence too. So we'll have that interest. But we'll share that interest with other minorities. So I think that's a mature, responsible way of defending group interests.
Now, is that going to be successful, Frank, though? Because, I mean, to me, it sounds a little bit South African, where you have a beleaguered sort of minority that's trying to stick up for themselves, and they maybe cooperate with, say, the Indians of South Africa against other different tribal groups of Black South Africa, which have their own particular interests. Is that going to work out?
I don't detect the South African. So the different one big difference with the South African situation is the whites controlled the state from colonial days. It was a product of colonialism and the fact that they were there first, actually.
Oh, no, I'm talking about in current times.
Oh, now.
Yeah, now. That's right. Isn't that, it sounds to me a little bit like,
well, I hope we don't go in that direction, because what you have there is a genocidal black nationalist regime in alliance with the Communist Party of South Africa, who frankly are ethnically cleansing the country of white, especially white farmers, and murdering, you know, or turning a blind eye while they're murdered in significant numbers. But I see what you're getting at. I think. What's the alternative? To pretend that there are not ethnic group interests? To say we're stepping back, we're not going to defend our groups anymore against vilification or discrimination. I mean, who's able to coordinate such a thing?
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether the other alternative might be that you drastically reduce immigration and you try to mold all these different comers, not on the basis of civic national, but you're trying to mold them into a new people. Because, you know, Australia, you said it was founded on the basis of ethno-nationalism, but, you know, there were different Irish and members of the British Isles, you call them ethnic groups. It didn't always get on, obviously. But over time, there was the creation of a new people here in the same way that there was, you know, creation of a new people in the United States and New Zealand and Canada and these places. And is it not at least possible, although probably a lot harder in many ways, to mold, at least not on the basis of civic nationalism, but to mold a new people through intermarriage and, you know, communal struggle together and ditching the multicultural doctrine, so that you can create again a new people here, rather than, like, you know, just adopting the multicultural, playing the game of the multicultural and using whites as an ethnic group that has to stick up for themselves in the same way that every other ethnic group does.
Shall I call it, until we think of a better name, the assimilationist model? Maybe we go back to Menzies' assimilationist model. Call it that. Yeah, absolutely, and I think that is unavoidable if we continue down the road of diversifying of the population. The only problem is it will take time. Time is a factor. I think we need to hold our breath for a few centuries until until ethnogenesis has taken place.
Yeah.
Now, here there are some problems with that. Let's take two of the populations. We're probably at around 6% Indian now. The Indian population's exploding, and we're at about 1.5 million people, ethnic Chinese, from different locations in Asia, but they're ethnically Chinese. How would they feel about this solution? So imagine us saying to them, imagine you and I formed one other formed a triumvirate, and we said, okay, so here's our solution. We're going to wait till you've all intermarried. Sorry about your traditions and your wish to retain your identity. Now we're all going to intermarry. But first we're going to stop. We're going to have a moratorium on immigration for, say, 200 years until we've done this. I'm being sarcastic deliberately. What I'm getting at is, doesn't sound realistic to me. It doesn't sound realistic. This is a dynamic power game. It's not something that just happened. This is a power game with highly intelligent actors that act as community leaders, as political entrepreneurs, and so on. And both those minorities, by the way, I chose them because they're the largest, but also they're remarkable people. You know, they come from a proud tradition. And China, they're both, by the way, both homelands are ethno-nationalist superpowers. China somewhat more down that track than India, but they're both overtly ethno-nationalist. Migrants, it is possible to immigrate to India if you're a Hindu. And of course, the Chinese also prefer, naturally, and I fully approve, by the way, because I want these countries to remain prosperous and united and peaceful. So I wouldn't want to happen to them what has happened to my own country, which is a government without permission of the population, basically diversified, transformed the country in a democratic way. So our challenge is to take this disaster. Don't forget, Australia is the least most successful multicultural society in the world. And we should always remember that there's another saying which goes with that, which is diversity is our greatest weakness. Mm-hmm. We need to keep repeating that. Diversity is our greatest weakness. We're the least most. Now, why do I think we're the least most successful multicultural society? Because they're getting away with it. That's why. Because it's a con job from the beginning, a semi-criminal con job, and they're getting away with it. So that's really successful from their point of view. For me, it's difficult to talk about this without getting a bit annoyed. I think that's coming across because it's just I was tricked as well as a student, as a young man in Australia, and I didn't have the research. Why didn't I have the research? Well, because it's not produced by the universities. That's why. It has been since then, and by the way, around the world, the study of ethnicity and immigration has really improved dramatically over recent decades. But I think it's unreasonable to say to the founding ethnic group of a country, everyone else can play multicultural politics, openly pursuing their demographic interests and their cultural interests and wanting to be high on the pecking order, but not you, because you're guilty and so on, as we were saying earlier. There's no way that Anglo-Celtic Australians of dignity would want to accept such a formula. Now, I think we're in for a bit of a tussle. This is the reality of balkanized countries. It's not always pretty. I absolutely agree with you. I hope we don't get to the level to the depths that South Africa has sunk, with its economy in a shambles, the bureaucracy in a shambles, people, farmers being tortured to death, massive affirmative action. Isn't that a nice term, affirmative action? Reverse discrimination. On practiced on a massive scale. I feel very sad about South Africa, what's happening with them. But it's good to hear President Trump come out recently, and in his inimitable style, to blurt it out. You know, it's a violation of human rights on a massive scale.
Yeah, and yet it's not portrayed that way in the media still, right? We are naturally inclined to think about and have sympathy for any sort of ethnic conflict that exists anywhere in the world. But the white South Africans, they're not portrayed in the same way.
No, they're not.
Do you know why that should be? I mean, is it simply because they were the top dogs and therefore they're always assumed, you know, they were in charge of the society, it's a legacy of that you can't feel sympathy because, I feel sympathy for them, don't worry about that, but I'm just trying to work out the psychology of why they can't, you know, clearly a beleaguered minority, when mainstream is not allowed to express sympathy for them in the same way that they are for the Yazidis or for the, Rohingya or whoever else, right?
You're exactly right. I think you're exactly right. For me, it reflects Australia's domestic ethnic hierarchy. It begins with the media. It begins with with the control of information and so on. And this has been happening for quite a while. So I read an old news report about Malcolm Fraser as Prime Minister. When was he Prime Minister? Only 75 until 83, an 8-year period. And he very proudly strode the world stage and supported black nationalism in South Africa and especially in Rhodesia. Why do I prefer the name Rhodesia to Zimbabwe? Why is that? Anyway, that's my problem. I have to adjust. And he helped more than any other, I think, more than any other foreign actor. He helped bring down the white regime in Rhodesia, resulting in mass starvation, mass repression. He brought in a communist government, in effect. And here's my point. He never had to apologize. The media was not on him saying, what have you done? Why have you destroyed? Okay, of course, reform was necessary and Rhodesia needed to build up a black middle class more and then transition as rapidly. Of course, I'm not denying that. The whites were a small minority and it was inappropriate for them to, you know, run the society forever. But what he did was so destructive, he never had to answer for it. Because the media were with him. How to explain it? By the way, I can't explain it. I have vague notions such as corporate elites.
In your environment these days, we have X and all sorts of stuff. We're bombarded. I get the impression that in the 70s, people weren't really aware of the immigration changes, and they weren't really aware of some of these. Picking up the paper on a day-to-day basis and was all sort of drifting by. You keep saying that there was never a full discussion of the change to our immigration policy, and it just sort of happened. And I can appreciate that today because there was never a discussion about the massive ramp up in numbers that occurred in the last 2 years. And it's not as though you're at the airport watching people come in on a daily basis, and suddenly the society sort of gradually changes around you, but you can't quite work out why that you know, it takes a while to put two and two together. And it seems to me that that must have been what occurred in the 70s as well. People were just didn't really. It's obviously we bear no ill will to anyone else. We've had these Colombo Plan students, but there seem to be a few more people turning up. And then it takes a while for people to fully appreciate change, the tweaks that have occurred, and the results that ends up bringing in.
I think one the basic cause of that was lack of information. People were not equipped with information to know what was happening. Because we live in a privatized society, the next suburb could become, transformed ethnically, and it wouldn't really impact maybe later on at school or something on when one goes shopping. So what caused the lack of information? Well, the cultural elites, again, this fits Kaufman's model. The cultural elites became radicalized, and they had a multicultural mission. They were motivated to overcome colonialism, of course, white colonialism, racism, of course, white racism, and so on. At the same time, at a high political level, there were moves made to keep the majority out of the decision loop. It's called democracy. When the people get a say in government occasionally, it's called democracy. So Bob Hawke was the most blatant about this. He said, look, the Labor Party's, my government's transformation of Australia ethnically could not have occurred without the connivance. He didn't use the word connivance. That's my word. The connivance of the Liberal Party. He saw it as a bipartisan, under the table agreement just to keep immigration away from elections. People should not have been able to vote for or against out of their hands. My favorite for most insidious opinion in this regard was Hawke's predecessor, Malcolm Fraser. And he said in his memoirs, he said, I just don't think Australians should be allowed to vote on immigration. They just get it wrong. We can diversify Australia as much as we want, and in the end, they'll just accept it. I'll just lie down and just accept it. So, we've had this. What's behind that, by the way? I would say a number of things, but one is overweening morality, an overweening sense of correctness, of moral superiority. How dare a politician in a liberal democracy set about transforming the country in a direction that majority never wanted? We have to rely on opinion polls because it was never put in elections. Whenever they were asked, which was not often, but when they were asked, they said, hell no, why would we want to change Australia? Australia's a great place. People liked Australia as it was. They felt part of the Australian nation. So they expressed their wishes. And so politicians had to overcome that. Why did they do that? Don't know, but they did it.
So it's the same today, isn't it, Frank? I mean, polls consistently say in Europe and elsewhere that the vast majority want to cut down on mass immigration, and consistently from both major political parties in England and Europe and Australia and elsewhere, neither of the major parties take up that. There's never any reflection of the public will on that matter.
It's true. It's true. There's another aspect of this that might interest you. It's, most of my life I've watched this happening and felt powerless, as other people feel powerless. I've always thought, look, I'm out of my depth when it comes to this sort of thing. People who are these powerful politicians who've got their law degree, they've done the whole thing, the whole preparatory thing. They've got their law degree. It's in their family, and they're connected, and they're sort of, they've been to the right university and all that sort of thing. And they've got the personality for it. But personally, I'm too excitable, I think, to be a politician. So I've waited for them to come forward, but it hasn't happened. As you said, it's still happening today. After Menzies, everything went downhill after Menzies and Cornwall. They were a pair, Menzies and Cornwall. After them, things went downhill. And I'm sick of waiting. Our elites have been stolen. Our elites have been stolen. Our natural leaders, those who care about us, who are a good leader, identifies with the people he's leading or she's leading, identifies with them, is part of them, feels their pain, actually feels their pain. It's called empathy. Our leaders don't. Why? I'm not sure why. But we can't wait any longer. We're actually losing our country. And that's not at all that's not at all the same as claiming, oh, all these immigrants are bad people. That's not the point. They're not us. They're not. They're fine people. They're just not us. And we can't wait forever. So in the meantime, we're trying something, and we've got this small society going.
Yeah, you have that nice quote in that book that you co-wrote, Anglophobia, that it's not only acceptable but ethical to defend one's individual and group interests. Loving one's own people is not the same as hating others, which I think seems self-evident to me. There's no malice involved in that. It's what people would agree. What do you think might be cause for hope in the future? I mean, we have seen the election of Donald Trump. We have seen new nationalistic anti-immigration parties arise in Europe, some better than others, I think. Do you think we are now finally at a bit of a turning point when people might be starting to get some of the arguments that you and others have made for a long period of time and convert them into policy?
Well, it could be. We'll only know if we keep on trying. But I've never seen people so open to new ideas, so open. I've never seen people, never experienced people so immune to the swear words, to the vilification, racist, Nazi, white supremacist. It goes on. It's like the Eskimos, isn't it? They have 50 different words for snow.
Right.
We've got 50 different words for white guilt.
Yeah.
But people are beginning to shake it off, especially young. So in the recent German elections, by the way, did you see a majority of young people voted AfD, the Patriotic Party, but a majority of people of boomers, my age group, voted CDU. The centre right. So that's a problem. But young people especially are not happy. They're confused. They know they'll never be able to afford a house. It looks like that most of them won't ever be able to get into the real estate market unless they move to Bourke, of course, or if they move to Broken Hill or something. So I think there is a chance. Also, we're in a different information climate. We have the internet, and I think that's helped break the 100% monopoly. Now, it's still a monopoly. There are monopolistic trends, but much weaker than they were just 20 years ago. So I think there is a chance.
Yeah, it can be done well, this correction, or it can be done really badly with all sorts of adverse consequences. I'm sort of hoping that it can be done in a sensible way, but recognizing that it may not be possible, right? That there are simply incredible challenges that have been built up because of flawed decision-making over a long period of time. But look, here's hoping. Frank, if people want to, I've only scratched the surface about the stuff that you've written over the years. If people want to find out more about you and about your books and other lectures and things, what's the best way that they can track you down?
I have an old website. I haven't looked at it for years. An old website which lists my publications until about 5 years ago, 8 years ago, called socialtechnologies.com.au, socialtechnologies.com.au. But for more recent material, I recommend go to Quadrant. There's a paywall, but some of the articles are on OpenView. Most of my writing since I returned to Australia in 2011, so over the last 14 years, has been in Quadrant, published in Quadrant. And then there's the BAC itself, so BritishAustralianCommunity.com.au. And videos, I've been making, we have been making videos, they're available. And I'd also recommend for the best compilation of arguments on the subject is that book, Anglophobia, The Unrecognized Hatred, Anglophobia, The Unrecognized Hatred by Richardson, Harry Richardson and Frank Salter, published just two or three years ago. So that's my prime recommendation. That's available on Amazon.
I've read it. It's an interesting book. Hey, Frank, I appreciate your time. Look forward to chatting with you further a variety of different functions and hopefully making some change in the years ahead. Thanks again.
Pleasure to meet you, Dan. Pleasure.
See you. Bye.